This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode, we talk with Katie L. Acosta. Katie is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Georgia State University and author of the recently published book, Amigas y Amantes. Her piece, We Are Family, appears in the winter 2014 issue of Contexts Magazine.
Thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
In your article, you explore the difficult work performed by sexually nonconforming Latinas to maintain and integrate their extended social support network rather than distance themselves from disapproving family members or their community. So what motivated you to do this research project, and then how did you go about conducting it?
I was motivated to do this work because back in 2007, when I started collecting the data, the research on women who love other women and are not white was almost non-existent at that time. Most of the research was looking at white middle-class women who were building families of choice with other, white middle-class or with their white middle-class partners. And as I kept reading the scholarship, I just kept thinking, this doesn't resonate with what I see in Latina families. So I kept thinking, there's more to this story, and I think there's a lot more to this story. And so I started to carve out this space for myself to do this research, I think, at that point. And what I quickly realized as I, started to take on the process of gathering the data was that it was actually really tough, Sexually nonconforming Latinas didn't hang out in a lot of queer community spaces. And I tried to reach out to organizations and community centers. And I found that, in the Northeast where I conducted this research, these spaces were predominated mostly by white women. So I would, I would attend like LGBTQ social events and, be one of the few Latinas who was in the room over and over again. So I had to get a little bit more creative, and I had to tap into like some of the few specifically LGBT Latina serving organizations that I knew about. And then I also reached out to some organizations on college campuses that were serving Latino populations. And my thought process was just that if I was able to reach groups that were serving Latino communities, that some of the members would likely identify as lesbian, bisexual, or queer. And so with those outreach strategies in mind, I, started to build connections. And, slowly, very, very slowly, actually, I was able to, start to build some of the data and start to do some of the interviews, and I started to do more and more participant observation.
Was it difficult for you to build rapport or trust with the participants, or were people just excited about the opportunity to tell their story?
I did have difficulty building rapport with people. It definitely took some time. I did have the advantage of being fluent in Spanish, and so I conducted a lot of interviews in Spanish with Latinas who were less comfortable speaking in English, and I was also able to do all of my advertisements and informed consent documents and, everything that was handed to the participants before they would agree to participate in the study. All of that was translated for them as well. So they would receive an English copy of a copy in English, and they would receive a copy in Spanish. And I think that, that did help a lot with being able to build rapport, making people feel a little bit more comfortable. If English is not your first language, then you're not necessarily going to feel like, you're not going to necessarily feel as comfortable being able to talk in that language for an extended period of time.
So what type of reactions did the women experience when they revealed their sexual preferences?
When they revealed, like, sexual preferences to other individuals?
Yeah, to their family or to community members.
One of the things that I find and I talk about in the book is that sexual identity mattered less to the families of origin than did the potential for visible markers of these sexual identities. So, and I guess in part, this is because participants tended to only talk to their parents about their sexualities once they were already in relationships with other women. And so, in which case, what they would be doing would be saying, you know, mom, dad, or, you know, family member, they would be saying, I'm in a relationship with another woman. And the issue of sexual identity at that point would be less important. But I think more importantly than the reaction that family members had to this kind of coming out, quote unquote, process, I think even more important than that is that family of origin's reactions were often guided by their concerns about gender nonconformity. So, you know, study participants, like I had one participant, for example, who did go to her parents and did say, you know, mom, dad, I want you to know that I'm a lesbian. And the very first thing that her father said to her was, well, you know, are you going to start dressing like a boy now? And so one of the things that I argue in the book is that families of origins, like their initial reactions and their long-term reactions to their daughter's choices and partners were going to be, were driven just as much, if not more so, by their need and their desire for their daughters to maintain whatever it was that they had decided were appropriate gender presentations of self.
So was that concern a result of fears over how people outside the family would view the gender performance?
I think that femininity was something that was very, very important to these families. I think that in part it was understanding that visible markers would stigmatize and could stigmatize these women in a way that they felt were, that they were afraid of. But I also think that these family members understood that there's a certain capital associated with displaying quote unquote appropriate standards of femininity. You know, they, I think we're very in tune to the fact that these young women were marginalized enough to begin with because they were Latinas. Some of them were not English dominant. You know, they were immigrants or they were the daughters of immigrants. And I think that families were very concerned with not wanting to create additional levels of marginality and were aware of the ways in which being gender nonconforming can mark someone as a target.
So you've talked about this a little bit, but I was wondering if you could discuss a little more for our listeners about the different types of acceptance that was given to people when they came out as being sexually nonconforming.
Yeah, sure. So in my work, I try really hard to complicate this idea that sexually nonconforming Latinas are either accepted by their family members or they're just not accepted. And it's just like I try to complicate this idea that these women are either coming out of the closet, quote unquote, or they don't come out of the closet. I find that the reality of these things are just much more complicated. And I think oftentimes people assume that acceptance means coming out to your mom and dad and having them say, it's okay, I love you anyway, and everybody living happily ever after. But what I found in my work is that many of the Latinas never have these clear moments of declaration with their origin families. They, you know, included their partners into family events as amigas, which is the Spanish word for friend. And they maintain these tacit understandings with their parents and their grandparents that the romantic nature of these relationships was just something that they just didn't really discuss. They didn't talk about. Now, sometimes when I try to explain this to people, they get uncomfortable and immediately people want to say, well, these women are closeted. But I try, what I try to get across in We Are Family, as well as what I get across in my book, is that these women don't see themselves as closeted. Their parents and their grandparents and their siblings all enjoy very close bonds with their partners. but they do so without verbally acknowledging the relationship.
Did the partners face any stigma from the families, or were they just treated as another friend and the sexual relationship was simply ignored?
Yeah, I think that the stigmas were much, much fewer in relationships, in familial relationships, where no one was actually verbally discussing these partnerships. And, you know, you have to juxtapose that experience with the other study participants who had a more quote-unquote conventional way of coming out with their families of origin. And they tended to report these long, drawn-out, you know, periods of acrimonious struggle as their loved ones learned to become more comfortable with, you know, the study participants' relationships with other women. And so the women who I interviewed who did not have these clear, distinct verbal declarations with family members, those who maintained more tacit arrangements with their families and who incorporated their partners into family circles as amigas, they generally tended to have less stigmatization and less negative outcomes within the family.
How central is religion to the level or even lack of acceptance that people face?
You know, I'm glad that you asked that because I devote a whole chapter in the book to this issue of religion. And it's something that I you know, wasn't really able to flesh out in We Are Family. What I find is that participants' parents sometimes used religion as a platform from which they could reject their daughters. So they will say, for example, I can't accept your relationship because it goes against my religious beliefs to accept your relationship. And this, I find, was really hurtful for women. And it created a lot of contradictions for them. Many of these women were raised as Christians, and they were oftentimes still religious in their adult lives. So they really needed to find ways to work with this contradiction of believing in God and participating in their churches, because that's the, you know, the avenue that they have to connect with God, but also struggling with the knowledge that their religion stigmatizes their relationships, you know? And so it was really a complicated one. It took me a while to be able to kind of wrap my brain around some of the what seemed to be contradictory actions that these women engaged in when it came time to talking about religion. So like, for example, religion was the only time that I noticed that the study participants alluded to having a struggle with the morality of their sexual lives.
So this is something they themselves face rather than their family?
Yeah. It was really the only time that I found that you know, there were instances where you could notice that there was this struggle. You know, they would, for the most part, talk about their lives, their relationships in very positive and self-affirming ways. And then when it came to religion, I sometimes saw this different side. You know, it was this side that showed this internal struggle with the morality of these relationships. And participants tended to react very intensely to the rejection that they sometimes got from friends or acquaintances or even their own family members. If they felt like their families were rejecting them in the way that I explained earlier, their reactions tended to be pretty intense. And they would essentially combat those rejections by engaging in their own forms of judgment. So they would make statements like, "You can't accept me or my relationship, but you're the one who had an extramarital affair," you know? Or they would say things like, "You can't accept me in my relationship, but you're the one who's sexually promiscuous." So it seemed like in a lot of ways they were using religious teachings about morality, sexual morality in particular, to judge other individuals who were rejecting them. And they seemed to do this rather than just focusing on the love and commitment that they had and that they were maintaining and nourishing with their partnerships.
I noticed in the article that men were generally absent, whether it was in terms of engaging in their own same-sex relationships or being the ones who are accepting the women engaging in their relationships. So I was wondering if this came up in conversation, even as a comparison case.
Well, I didn't find that the participants talked about this much as a comparison, but I will say that I think one of the biggest limitations in my work is that I was not able to have more dialogue with or about the fathers of sexually nonconforming Latinas.
Why do you think that might be the case?
Well, what I was finding was that in most cases, the participants who I interviewed would default to talking about their moms and the problems that they had with their moms. And at first I didn't understand, you know, why that was so intensely the focus. But what I later came to realize is that moms seem to be working as mediators between their sexually nonconforming daughters and the rest of the extended family. So, you know, whatever issues or concerns the rest of the family had, you know, these mothers were the ones who would then convey that information back to daughters, and daughters would then, you know, go back to mothers and plead and argue their cases. And so these moms were in this in-between role, which I think made that so much the focus of the conversation for the study participants when I interviewed them. And I think it made it appear more so like they were, you know, the only ones actively participating, which, you know, I don't think was actually the case. I think fathers had very strong concerns and, you know, had their own sets of opinions. It was just that the issue of mothers seemed to dominate a lot more.
So gay marriage has continued to be a widely discussed and still contentious political issue. Was the right to marriage viewed as an important step by your participants or something that they brought up a lot in the interviews?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you asked this because I actually wanted to say more about this in the article and I didn't have the space to.
Yeah, with 3,000 words, you really just can't cover everything.
Yeah, it's pretty limiting. So, first of all, when I collected the data for this project, I think there were only 3 states that were actually recognizing same-sex marriage. You know, this was 2007, and there had been no Supreme Court ruling. And in fact, most of the interviewees could not legally get married in the state where they resided at the time that I interviewed them. That's first. It's weird because it hasn't been that long, and so much has changed now that, you know, it's even hard to even think about that. I know it sounds crazy, but it really was still pretty new in terms of the number of states that were allowing it at the time and like the number of participants who actually had access to it. But then I found that a wide range of feelings existed around this marriage issue for the women. You know, some of them really saw no need and still see no need to take this step in their lives. And others got engaged and started planning their weddings as soon as it became legal in their state. But for those women who did start planning their weddings, you know, I think that these women were equally invested in the public visibility that they believed would come from their weddings. So I think, you know, the discourse in the media is all about legal protection and it's all about legal rights, right? But for these women, it was definitely more than just about the legal rights. This was about public visibility from family. So they were less interested in going to the courthouse. It was really important to them that they have a wedding with their family, with their friends, with tradition. Same-sex marriage for them was about this opportunity to have others openly support and acknowledge their relationships. And I found that to be just as important, and in some cases, even more important than the actual legal rights. And I think it's important also, as I make that statement, to say that, you know, this might be very particular to the sample, to the actual participants that I interviewed, because like I said earlier, some of my participants were undocumented immigrants, and some of them had legal status in the United States, but they had few financial resources. And what that meant is that while a lot of them really could stand to benefit a great deal from the, you know, financial benefits that come with marriage, these women were also often very weary of state institutions. They were sometimes reticent about engaging in a legal bureaucratic structure because they had this distrust for whether or not these systems could ultimately be used against them. And so that piece complicated quite a bit for this population, the relationships that they had with this, you know, same-sex marriage discourse that was, you know, slowly taking over and, you know, at this point has exploded to become so important.
I was wondering if we could conclude with a little bit of a bigger question. So earlier you mentioned that the majority of work on family and sexuality has simply failed to examine the Latina context. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you think this might be or if it speaks to anything in the discipline.
Yeah. I think it's very hard. We are talking about a marginalized population of women. They aren't going to be as forthcoming with researchers. There are trust issues. There are language issues, in addition to just some of the basic constraints on their time. And I think anyone who wants to do research on this population, you really need to want it, and you have to be really patient. And I think it helps a lot if your study participants can identify with you to some degree. You know, I think that this insider-outsider debate becomes particularly crucial here. So if the participants can feel like they can build a rapport with you, it matters a great deal. And I think that in part, the absence that there's been in the scholarship on research on sexually nonconforming Latinas specifically is related to who's actually doing the research and, you know, who actually is able to gain access to this population. And I think that it's something that, you know, it's getting a little bit easier with social media, but in a lot of ways, you're talking about a community of people that have multiple marginalizations on that they wrestle with regularly. And I think that at some levels, it can be a big challenge to be able to do work on this community because of that.
Did you have the chance to share any of your writings with people that took part in your study or the people of the community?
I have. I have been able to share. You know, some people were very interested in following the project through and see, you know, where what's happened with it over the years. And so I have been able to share in some instances. And I've gotten very, very positive feedback, I think. I think that, interestingly, there was some sense among the participants for this study that they were being ignored in larger discourses, and that there was some sense of like validating and recognizing that their experiences mattered. And so in that way, I was well received in terms of doing this research to start with, because I think a lot of people who I interacted with understood the value and the importance of it and wanted to support a project that, you know, at the time was really rare.
Well, thank you again for joining us. It really was great talking to you and hearing about your research.
It was great talking to you as well. Thank you so much. Thank you.